About 4 months after we're conceived, we begin to hear. Maybe this is what it sounds like. This is A Mother's Symphony, composed by Muriel and Walter Murch. You are hearing voices from NPR, the best of public radio, spreading some motherly love. We start with a couple young moms. In 1996, Radio Diaries producer Joe Richman gave Melissa Rodriguez from New Haven a microphone and tape recorder. Melissa was 18 and pregnant. Joe asked her to make an audio journal of her life.
Okay, let's see what old songs I have here. Oh, yeah, this is a classic. Well, to my generation. Here it is, Independent by Salt and Pepper.
Hi, I'm going to introduce myself. My name is Melissa Rodriguez. My friends call me Missy.
I'm Puerto Rican, if no one noticed that yet.
I'm 18 years old. I live in New Haven, Connecticut.
In a little tight one-bedroom apartment. Right now I'm in my bedroom. I love being in my bedroom. There's everything here. All my books, my TV, VCR, my baby's crib. I'm 8 months pregnant, 8 and a half. It's a boy. Everybody asks me, what are you gonna name him? What are you gonna name him? I don't even know what I'm gonna name him. I mean, I tried everything. I even called the psychic line. Talk about crazy. I called the psychic line. I was like, can you see who it is? They didn't even know. And they psychic. This is my plan, to have the baby. And I think when I look at the baby, I think I will know. My baby father's name is Wayne, and we're sort of together. We're not in a serious relationship. And I didn't think that I was going to get pregnant. It just happened. It was just like, I just started my life. I just started to go to school. I just started working. And I just didn't have anything settled yet.
Why don't you lay up on the table on your left side, okay?
Every couple of weeks, I have to go get my checkup.
We're gonna listen to the heartbeat now.
That's it. I heard his heartbeat for the first time, and I kind of believed I was pregnant, and I was still in, like, this denial stage.
Doctors will ask me questions, like, am I depressed, or if I have any problems, and they want to know what I'm eating and how much of it am I eating. I lied a lot and told them that I was eating a lot of vegetables, but the only vegetable I was eating is lettuce and tomatoes on my double cheeseburger with extra cheese from McDonald's.
All right, I'll see you next week.
All right.
Well, I got to be honest with you. I was kind of thinking about abortion, but I see it as more like killing a human being. And adoption, I don't believe in adoption either, because I was in foster homes, and that's just as good as being adopted. I was in 8 foster homes, 5 residentials, and 7 group homes. And it's just, you feel so out of place, and you would just think, you know, this family is not even mine.
Let me get my photo album.
Well, I'm going through my photo album to see who's in here. Most of my pictures are friends. Family members come up once in a blue moon. Oh, I have a picture right here. Perfect picture, too. This was when I was 2 years old, 1 year old. That's my mother. And we was at my little cousin's birthday party. She looked a little fat because she just had me. Still got her roll in her stomach. But other than that, she's really pretty. Yeah, short, curly hair, thick. She looks like she's trying to dress like a teenager, which I think she was at the time. But I look just like her. My friends aren't really my family.
Sometimes we would just go out driving around in New Haven. And we have like a little rating system. Like, we'll take points away if he has an ugly car or if he looks raggedy. And if he doesn't score at least an 8, then no one will talk to him.
Patty! Patty!
Come here, girl! Hey, Patty, girl! You look cute! I like that!
All my friends have kids except for one. The good reasons why they have kids is because they think they're cute and they feel like something belongs to them. They know that that person will love them always. As far as I'm concerned, I'm still going to be a party girl. I'm just have to cut that in half. I'll probably just go out once a week rather than 5 days a week.
Well, that is the bomb, baby. That outfit. Oh, with the high waters in the shoes.
Yeah. Well, we did have an excitement event this week. Nurse called me. And she says to me, she says, Miss Rodriguez, we need you to come in as soon as possible to cure 2 infections that you have. And I'm thinking, infections? I got an ear infection? What kind of infection is this? She was like, no, you have, syphilis and whatever else comes with it. And I'm like, wait a minute, you get that from having sex? She was like, yes. I was like, you must have the wrong chart. We don't have that hair. We didn't have this hair, you know. And I'm just looking over to my left. And I look at my baby father. I'm like, I'm going to kill him. I really am. So he gets up. I get off the phone. He gets up, walks to the bathroom. And I look over at him. He looks at me. He's like, what's wrong? I was like, come here. Take a seat. I want to speak to you about something. You know, all calm, not to scare him or nothing. Right then and there, I already knew. I said, that's it. I knew he was going to cheat. I had a feeling he cheated on me, but I never knew that. If he was going to cheat on me, I mean, he would at least been protected. So I'm going off at him. I'm like, listen, I can't even look at you right now. Just get out my face. Take a walk or something. Because I will kill you if you stay around here, okay? Yeah, it's probably him calling again. Should we answer it and talk to him? Nah. Yeah, he hung up. He hung up. Today is October the 9th. And I have a brand new baby boy, 7 pounds. His name is Isaiah Seto. And he was born at 1:30, right? 1:30, right?
1:17.
1:17, exactly.
He was born an hour ago.
I was watching. 1:17.
And we would have recorded the birth, but it happened so fast.
About half an hour.
You know, so I'm sorry you couldn't hear all the pain, but it was easy.
He's so adorable.
He's going to be a good baby, too. You see how he's going to cry? He just came out, was chilling. Give him a little cry, make sure his lungs was right, and he just started chilling. I can't believe this whole thing was inside of me.
Congratulations, Missy.
Thank you.
When I came home, it was a funny feeling. Just myself was walking in the house, but he really didn't care. He got so used to the house so fast, you know.
Ooh, I smell something. What's that? Woo!
And how do I like my motherhood here?
The funny thing about having a baby, especially a boy, is that he always pisses on me. Always. Every time I change him, is just always peeing on me. I don't know why. He's marking his territory like he said, this is mine. So, that's kind of cute. As far as my own mother, you know, I'm debating on if I should call to let her know that her grandson is here. I don't know. I don't think she really will care. She's just that kind of person. But I'm going to try to call her. So let's see if I can find her number here. I haven't talked to her in a while, so let's see. Well, I guess she won't find out that she has a grandson. I'm the same age as my mother was when she had me. I think it was a mistake that I had the baby so young. I should have waited. I mean, I feel like I'm more like the keeper, just the keeper. I take care of him and that's my job. That's just it. I'm not saying I'm sad that I had my son. I hate getting up in the middle of my sleep and walk into the kitchen with my eye closed to try to find a bottle and heat it up. And he's crying, and I feel like I'm doing something wrong. I hate it at that time. But when I'm up and he's up, he smiles at me. I like looking at him and say, that's me. Looks just like me. It's fun to see somebody who has your blood and looks just like you and is yours. Actually yours. I don't know. It's just, when I hold them, I just feel, you know, important to them.
Melissa Rodriguez, Teen Mom, was part of the series Teenage Diaries, produced by Joe Richmond for RadioDiaries.org. You are hearing voices. Our next dose of motherly love comes from producer Erin Mishkin. She recorded a day with Amy Jo and her two toddlers.
Very, very busy morning. We started our day at 6:15 this morning. What was I doing?
Hello, my name is Amy Jo. I'm a single mother. Shawnee's 3. Joshua's 15 months old. They have me 24/7. I eat sleep when they let me. It's gut-wrenching, hair-pulling, fun-filled adventure. You want to come?
I usually wear a little bit of eyeliner in the morning because I have very small eyes. And I hate them. So I just put some eyeliner on. Oh, beautiful. Where's my tiara? I need my tiara to go to work and clean my houses.
I clean houses for a living right now. Cleaning houses offers me a lot of flexibility, which I need. I'm currently residing in a 3-bedroom apartment that I acquired about 1.5 years ago.
There you go, baby. Do I got to turn it on somehow?
Yeah.
It's not turning on, honey. Oh my gosh, I'm gonna have to pick up some batteries tomorrow. That's another $2. I think I was in Portland maybe almost 2 years when I met Shawnee and Joshua's father on a Friday night at one of the bars that I had went to, and completely missed that letter L on his forehead. He was a heavy, heavy drinker, and I just found myself drinking right along with him. You know, he's a I can't make it to work today drinker. Lost my job again today drinker. I look at that little boy and I'm like, God, your father is such a he's a thief. He's a liar. He's 36. He has nothing. There's no way in hell I'm going to let you grow up to be like that. I'm going to teach him that, you know, women are to be treated like, you know, queens. You know, and if you don't like her, just say I'm out of here. But his father couldn't get out of there till he put his fist through the wall and or opened up the fridge and
emptied it out, followed by some choice words. He could never just leave. It had to be a grand exit, you know.
You're going to wear your sneakers today. You're not wearing your boots. No.
When she was 18 months old, I left him to get sobriety, to get a peace of mind, to build back up my self-esteem, my self-worth. I checked myself into Crossroads, a facility for down-and-out women, whether it's drug addiction or alcoholism.
You can have yogurt. Would you like some yogurt? Yes?
It took me to be crying in a hotel room with my daughter on Route 1 with nothing. And that's the only place I had to go. And for 2 weeks, I stayed in that hotel room waiting to get into Crossroads. Then they came and they picked me up. That day, I will never, ever forget. But it only was like a 40-minute ride. I remember I ripped off every fingernail that I had. I just wanted to jump out at every red light. But then, every now and then, I'd hear my daughter in the back seat. The lady that was driving me reached over with her hand, and she put her hand on my hand, and she said, "You're doing the right thing." And I kind of smiled, and I nodded, and she goes, "You are." She goes, "You're making a choice of a lifetime for you and your daughter."
All right, well, we gotta go. Mama's got her cell phone.
And I made a promise to my daughter that we were gonna do this. You know, this is not our life. This is a stepping stone to our life. And if he's not going to help me give it to you, by God, I'm going to give it to you.
Ponytail is looking good.
I leave every morning and I smell like a rose. And then I come home, I smell like a bucket of bleach.
Kids are fed, bathed. It's my favorite time of night. Good job, Shawnee. Do the top. She, unless I tell her, will never know what she did for me. That's quite spectacular for somebody who's, what is she, like a little over a foot tall? To make such an impact.
Say goodnight.
Good night, Josh.
Fluffy fleece blanket. That's his favorite and his little tunes.
I do cry from time to time. I have a 3-year-old that I talk to all the time, and all I say is, you know, please put that down. Please get out of that. Please don't do that. So I don't have much adult conversation. I don't have anybody to tell me. Well, I do now. My daughter says she loves me all the time, which is great. But, you know, I find myself yearning for that companionship, somebody to hold me and, you know, maybe bring me flowers. And that's the only thing I want is a little more financial security right now. Everything's tight, right down to the dollar, you know. I got 30 hours in last week, and that hurts. That's $300, and it's not enough. This is the breezeway to my apartment. I've got my 2 white chairs and my, like, wicker table, just big enough for, you know, a couple cups of coffee and an ashtray, and then I surrounded the ceiling with white Christmas lights. It's just so serene and so peaceful. It's just amazing just how much that does for me. It really is. Because at one point in my life was so chaotic, bouncing around, and it helps me count my blessings and keeps me strong. It keeps me strong. So we're here. We're gonna grow. This is just a stepping stone. You know, I'm not done yet. What, honey? You ready for your vitamin? Okay, I'm coming in.
The day he died, I was gonna go out with my girlfriends, and Rich had a new friend named Steve. They were riding bikes, and I said, "Come on, we got to go pick up the babysitter." And he didn't want to go. He wanted to go to the corner because he wanted to watch the sunset. And I thought to myself, I don't want to tie him to his mama's apron strings. So I said, "Will you watch for cars?" And I left. When I came back, I saw this crowd of people at the end of the street and ambulance lights. And I knew the minute I opened the car door and put my feet on the ground that it was Rich. And I got out of the car and I just started running. A guy had been hot rodding through our neighborhood. The car flipped over and it landed on Rich. And all I can remember is they had pulled the driver out and he kept saying, "Oh my God, what have I done? What have I done?" They put me in a police car and I just started screaming. And the ambulance driver came to me at the hospital and said, there was nothing we could do, he's gone. And I can remember having my back to the wall and I just slid down on my butt, leaning against the wall. And he said, "Ma'am, I'm not supposed to tell you this, but he was dead at the scene." He'll never know what that meant to me, because one of the things that was the hardest for me was, what if he was suffering and I wasn't there for him, you know? And the worst part is when you realize you're going to live because you just want to die. I thought I wouldn't live 10 minutes, and I was astonished when I'd live 10 days and mortified when I'd lived 10 months and not even grateful yet when I had lived 10 years. I was just mostly surprised. And there was no one more astonished that I'd survived it than myself. When you lose your child, it's like somebody has just amputated a huge chunk of your heart. And the difference is people can't see the amputation. I miss him terribly. He was just a happy kid, and it's been a bittersweet thing that he died watching a sunset.
That was Myra Dean, recorded for the StoryCorps project, StoryCorps.net. Before that was Amy Jo's Day by Aaron Mishkin of PublicRadioRedux.com and the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies. And this is A Mother Symphony by Muriel and Walter Murch. We continue with more motherly love in a minute on Hearing Voices.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. From NPR, this is Hearing Voices.
Do you want to do an interview?
I don't know, Ben.
Might as well get the first one over with.
You got the questions all prepared?
No.
You are hearing voices with some motherly love. Here's producer Ben Adair and his mom.
What are you worried about?
Well, I guess it's that I had a lot of ambivalence about having a deaf mother as a kid. So I suppose it's exploring that has me nervous, or maybe nervous is the wrong word. Worried. Well, there's a certain amount of ambivalence about making this trip.
I want to ask just directly, just because I feel like I need to get the answer on tape, you know. Why are you taking this trip? I mean, what brings it on, and why are you doing it?
Well, Mother died last April after close to a year of recovering from an injury. And when Mother died, I kept asking. My father could hear, my mother could not, and I kept asking the question of why would a hearing man marry a deaf woman, and trying to think that through and realizing that there was a lot about my mother that I did not know firsthand. Things that I got glimpses of that made me want to go back and try to get a better view of what she might have been like and the kinds of things she would have faced as a young person so that I could get some understanding of this.
Do you feel like there were things keeping you from understanding her while she was still alive? I mean, or is it just that after she died, you kind of, do you know what I mean?
Why didn't I ask her those questions before she died?
Well, I mean, yeah.
How do you ask your mother why a hearing man would have married her? She felt acutely her deafness and felt that it made her less of a person.
State Highway Alternate 45, about 10 miles outside of West Point. It's raining. It's been raining all day. It's very gray.
There are things that happen and they cut you like a knife. Sometimes it's like a long kitchen knife driven straight into your gut. You bleed, and maybe you bleed for a long time. Maybe you never get well. Sometimes the knife is like a surgeon's scalpel. It opens you up, and it hurts like hell, but it cuts out all the bad parts, and eventually you do heal, and you're better than you were before. My mom will tell you that her life's been cut in three, like car tracks split a flooded Mississippi highway. First, she was there, and then on this cold morning 5 years ago, my dad came downstairs and left her. After that, Mom played solitaire on the computer for a really long time. Then, last April, her mom died. And death is sad. I don't have to tell you that. It's really, really hard. But when Grandma died, it was like that surgeon's knife came and repaired what had happened to my mom. So one morning last May, she woke up. She went downstairs and didn't turn on the computer. Instead, she went biking. She went out on a date. She started planning this trip we're taking down south. She decided to get to know her mom a little better.
Okay, this is kind of what the downtown looks like. This is kind of the kinds of storefronts I remember. See how the sidewalks are a few steps up?
Grandma was born Bessie Grace McMullen. And in southern Mississippi, McMullens are like kudzu. There's McMullen Motors in Hattiesburg. There are McMullen Doctors and McMullen Architects in Jackson. There's the J. Elliott McMullen Library in Newton, Mississippi.
That's my house. I think so. It was so tiny.
Right now, Mom and I are just arriving in West Point, Mississippi, where she spent ages 4 through 10. It's where she remembers her family the happiest.
Yeah, I do.
Actually, it's where she remembers her mother the happiest. Her dad fell between jobs in West Point, first working in a hatchery and then for a meat packer. He missed his own family in East Central Georgia, and he didn't really like that Grandma's family was so near. He was never very popular with her folks, and after my grandparents eloped, Grandma's family liked to voice their disapproval, let's say. Great-granddad McMullen, he once sold granddaddy's car right out from under him. At a loss.
We'll come back in the daylight, maybe. Turn the hazard lights off.
You do a lot of talking on road trips, sitting in the car, sitting in motels. And on a trip like this, on a trip with my mom, there's not a lot of small talk. Did you get, after your mom died, did you get really sad?
Well, of course I did. I miss her. One of the things I thought about when I was trying to write or think about what I would say as a eulogy at her service was the fact that she was the only person in the world that I really used sign language with. So it's like being the last person that speaks my language when she died. When I'm using sign, it's a connection from my hands to my gut to my heart and my face. My whole body is involved with that, and that's just, that feels like home. And I don't use that language anymore. So I miss that. And I dreamed about my mother before we made this trip. And I woke up crying. Because we all have regrets about the way we related to our parents as children and adolescents and young adults. And when they're dead, you can't go back and make up for that. You can only be sorry that those things happened. And you can be glad for the times that things were good and try to remember those a lot more than you remember the things you're sorry about.
It's always a lot easier to remember the things you're sorry about, though.
Yeah, they seem to stick in your head a lot more.
On Sunday, we drive a couple hours south to a tiny town called Newton, Mississippi. This is where Grandma grew up. Well, I say that, but really she was just born here. There were four deaf kids in the family, and each one was sent to boarding school in Jackson at the Mississippi School for the Deaf.
It's a long time since you've been down here. Come in.
This is Ben.
And this is,
I'm
Today, only my great-uncle Elliot and his wife Ruth live in Newton. Elliot's the youngest of my grandma's brothers. He was mayor of Newton for 20 years. Mom and I arrive in Newton late in the afternoon, and immediately we start feeling a little strange. I mean, it sounds silly, but we were expecting to be treated all long and lost. Instead, we get sitting in the sitting room. We get up and down glances and awkward pauses. The birds in the backyard are the only ones comfortable with my microphones. At lunch the next day, Mom's in a mood to reminisce, but Elliot's forward-thinking. He doesn't like to look to the past. My cousin once removed Janice is absolutely giddy. She wants to go to the Indian casino. Great Aunt Ruth, well, she's a great hostess. She serves us butter beans, black-eyed peas, chicken casserole, and that funny salad with a piece of lettuce, a canned pear, and a dollop of mayonnaise on top. She serves on the good china. Eventually, Mom and me, we catch on. We're company, not so much family. Mom starts to wonder, maybe we should go to Jackson early, cut our visit short. We're not feeling as welcomed as we'd hoped. After lunch, Elliot and Janice take us on a tour of Newton. They show us the downtown, the city hall. They tell us about the feud in the Baptist church that turned neighbor upon neighbor for a short time. Elliot takes us to the graveyard. And that's where something happened. Elliot was showing us his parents, my great-grandparents' grave. He was saying how he's the only one who comes down here and keeps the fire ants from crawling around. He makes sure the grass has enough water. I bend down and brush the leaves off the base of the headstone.
I tell you, if any of y'all want to be buried here, we'll put you right in there.
Well, the McMullen plot is pretty big here, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's plenty big. You can be buried right there by me.
Where's your spot, Danny?
Huh?
Where's your spot?
Right there.
It's funny how something little can touch you. There was a battle in Newton during the Civil War. Benjamin Grierson attacked the rail lines in Newton. He burned two locomotives, 25 freight cars. His men heated the rails and twisted them around trees. My cousin Janice was explaining this great defeat, and my mom said laughing, "A great defeat for who?" Janice looked at Mom sideways. Heck, I looked at Mom sideways, but Uncle Elliot just laughed. He told Janice to go get the car so he could show us the library.
Y'all been to the Newton Cemetery now.
There's Mother and Ina, but no Evelyn, see?
One of the few things Elliot told us about growing up is how much his father cared for his deaf children. He said that when his dad took the oldest daughter, Grandma's sister Ina, to the Mississippi School for the Deaf, they were both so broken up. She cried and cried, and he stayed with Ina until she fell asleep that night. Then he sneaked out. It broke his heart.
So this is 29 to 31. Brooks Monaghan. That's the guy Mother thought she was in love with at one point.
The school doesn't have many records going back to the 1920s, when the McMullen kids first enrolled. Those are kept at the Mississippi State Archives. We go there and find biannual reports, mentions of the dilapidated buildings, the fires, the teachers' frustrations. We find Grandma's name on the student rosters, and later, in the 30s, on the teachers' lists. That's when she met my granddad, who was working in the dairy.
That deaf Mississippian that I was asking about is put out by the printing class.
The lithography shop put out these beautiful booklets every 2 weeks called The Deaf Mississippian. Insider stories written by students, words of wisdom from people like Plato and Jefferson Davis. They also have excerpts from the diaries the students kept.
Okay, so here's a something in the primary department. This issue is October 15th, 1923. My papa came to see me yesterday. I was glad to see him. He gave some gum to me. I thanked him. He went home last night, Bessie McMullen. This one is the next issue, November 1st, 1923. The girls went to town Saturday afternoon. I bought a box of cakes. I paid 5 cents for them. Bessie McMullen.
That's pretty funny. I could never really talk with Grandma. I know a few signs. We'd sit next to each other and pass notes, but mostly, we just watched television. In these tiny excerpts, approved by teachers and printed in big books for parents, there's a person I never knew. Grandma was cute. She taught the other kids to play baseball. She missed her parents terribly. She rebelled by falling in love. We read every issue they have. That night, we get in our car and drive south to Hattiesburg.
Sue and Cecil. Yes, Sue and
Hello.
Cecil.
Oh, wonderful. She doesn't even remember Sue.
Yes, I do. How are you?
My great-uncle Elliot is the John Wayne of relatives, all square-jawed and silent. His brother, Grandma's brother, Victor, is more Michael Keaton. Victor's friendly. He's got this funny energy about him. He cusses a little bit and wags his finger when he says something important. In Hattiesburg, Victor and his wife, Aretha, have arranged a huge luncheon for us, and family come from all over to meet the long-lost cousins from up north. Almost a dozen people on a Thursday afternoon.
I tell you what, I think he had great sympathy for his deaf children. Great sympathy for them.
Victor likes to talk about the past, so after lunch, he, my cousin once removed Cecil, Mom and me, we all sit around and shoot the breeze. We talk about what it was like for Grandma and Victor as kids, how great-granddad McMullen made everyone learn sign language so they could communicate with each other.
You said Elliot said he learned sign before he could talk. Well, I expect that's pretty true. I expect I was almost in the same situation.
It's easy to get sad again, but mostly we talk about the good times, about when Grandma and Granddad got married, how they came to see Victor right afterwards. We talk about Cecil's mamina, Grandma's oldest sister, and how she worked in a tire factory in Akron, how she heard deaf people could get jobs up there. In the morning, Victor has some things to do, so we go visit a few more relatives, and then we hit the road. We drive for 2 days, from Mississippi up to Michigan. Mom wants me to see Grandpa before I go. The weather's beautiful, and we listen to Lyle Lovett while curving our way through the Kentucky mountains. I'm here with my grandpa. Hello. Do you hear me?
Yeah.
Is there anything that you'd like to say into this microphone here?
Do what?
Is there anything you'd like to say to this microphone?
Well, I don't think so. I don't like to talk to dummies.
Mom wants to use the excuse of the trip to ask Granddad about Grandma, but she doesn't think she'll get a truthful answer. She says he's been romanticizing their relationship a lot since she died, and he doesn't have a good grasp on the facts.
So how long did you and Mother date before you got married?
I don't know.
So you got married in January 1941.
I don't know that. I think we got married in 41, and it was about the second, third, or fourth day in January, I think, right after the first.
Mm-hmm.
Mama was a beauty. And nobody could compare to her.
It's hard for Mom because her family life was always very complicated.
Well,
for a long time, Mom's sister wouldn't come and visit Granddad. She was that mad. And if I wanted to, I could tell you things that would make your fist clench and your heart break. But, you know, I'm not going to tell you these things because as we're sitting here and talking, Granddad's sweet.
Well,
he misses Grandma so much.
It wasn't too long before Bessie's dad come to school for the deaf. When he found me and Bessie, we was in an apartment.
And even though I'm sitting right next to him, I miss my Granddad right now. Married. I miss Grandma, too.
Were you married already?
Yeah.
Eventually, Mom wants to go. We take some pictures. Granddad tells me I need a shave. We get in the car and start the short drive back to Chicago.
when we started the trip, you said one of the reasons you wanted to go was to find out about your mom and to find out why your dad would want to be with your mom. Is that really why you wanted to go on this trip?
That was not the only reason.
We were both looking for something.
No matter how
a sense that even
been,
after Grandma died, there was still a lot of her around in Mississippi.
To be
and in us.
The way we were welcomed by them and for everyone just to be happy to see us. And no one said.
And we found that. Mom found that. I said before that when Grandma died, it was like Mom had this wound that finally started to heal. And healing's a slow process. It doesn't happen all at once. But driving back to Chicago, we didn't mention the sad things anymore. Instead, there was how Grandma wore her emotions on her face and how Mom does that too. How important it is to express yourself and how, unbelievably, we were still getting along. One thing I know is that when you're healing, you sleep a lot. I've been sleeping a lot on this trip, and I'm still really tired. I'm looking forward to getting back to Los Angeles, where my bed is waiting for me, where, even though my family isn't right there, they're around.
I've just really enjoyed it.
I think that's a good note to end this recording on.
Ben Adair and his mom. Ben heads American Public Media's Sustainability and Global Climate Change Initiative.
I also have had a great time with you. Thank you.
Thank you. It's nice to have a kid that likes to spend time with you.
You are hearing voices spreading some motherly love. Here's Katie Davis.
Here's how it goes when I meet someone. I start looking for the right moment to slip it in. They might be mentioning their husbands, wives, children, and I'm thinking, now? No. No, not yet. If I reveal it too early, the shift is irreversible. You live with your mother? Right, I live with my mother. We're great friends. Oh, you live with your mother. Old maid, pathetic loser, moocher. And this is when I start speaking fast. I pay rent, you know. We have a big row house, a garden, three dogs, a player piano. I could never afford a house all by myself. What's that like, living with your mother? Oh, it's great, I say. I have lived by myself, you know, in New York City for years, then in Mexico City, the biggest city in the world. I choose to live with my mother. I like her. And besides, on Sunday, she fries chicken. I could never, ever, ever live with my mother, they pronounce. Around now, I pull out my self-righteous world culture card. You know, in Latin America, everyone lives with their parents, and it's not weird. A man from Sierra Leone told me the other day, I am lucky to live with my mother. We North Americans are so broken off from our families, from people, it's no wonder we're lonely. The worst, though, is when I meet a man with a hint of promise, and I can't duck his question. Who answered the phone? I watch his eyes sort of flutter when I tell him, my mother, and then his calculation. Breakfast in bed is definitely out of the question. It turns out this mother thing is ingrained, even in me. I meet an old boyfriend at an art opening, and he looks good, too. Purple jacket, creased linen pants. But when Gustavo tells me he's living with his mother, I think, gee, I guess he's having a hard time. And I cannot get past the sour taste of pity. When he borrows money from me and never pays it back, I think, well, what did you expect, Katie? He lives with his mother. It's a lot to overcome. So I've developed a new strategy. When the question surfaces these days, I pause and say, no, I don't live alone. My mother lives with me. It changes everything. Move the words around and I'm the powerful, compassionate one, taking care of my mother as she ages. Yes, my mother lives with me.
Happiness is love. Happiness is love. Love make you keep happy. You can't just love yourself and you don't love other people. You got to love people. And the love is right there. It makes you feel happy to know that you're my neighbor. And I love you. And you could able to come over today to invite me over. What do you think that is? I'm feeling happy.
Same.
Yes.
It's a simple recipe, I guess.
Yes. I'm feeling happy. Good. To know that, you know, somebody cares. And that's a big love. You know, I can come out through the door and I say, good morning. What make you feel so happy? Right? Oh, love. That's what I find it is. Make you happy. I come out in the morning, I see Mr. Gary. I can say, good morning, Mr. Gary. I can sit and talk to him because I'm happy. I can go back in and I can smile and say, oh, we were changing tone this morning. Hey? So nice. So good. I love that. Love make you happy.
I walked into the bookstore and there they were, a pile of Far Side off-the-wall calendars, the one where you tear a cartoon off each day from a pad about 4 inches square. You know the one. Here's an example. This one's a classic. View from an airline cockpit, a mountain goat seen through the clouds. One pilot says to the other, say, what's a mountain goat doing way up here in a cloud bank? I haven't had a calendar for years, but I remember when my mom did. I had brought it from her desk at home to the hospital she was at. I suggested she pace herself, but by the time I came back, she had devoured them all, marking the good ones. She was starved for many things. She had NPO on her chart, nothing per aura, nothing by mouth. She could chew on ice, crushed ice. Crohn's disease had put a stop to her intestines, a very painful stop. Two frames. At the top, on a cloud, an angel says to a line of recent arrivals, welcome to heaven. Here's your harp. On the bottom frame, in a fiery cave, the devil says, welcome to hell. Here's your accordion. Each trip to the hospital, I would bring over a McDonald's quarter pounder with cheese, fries, and a Coke. The combination was heaven for her. Not that the food tasted great or anything, but the taste brought back memories. Once, my mom took my best friend and me to McDonald's for lunch. She wasn't hungry, so she just watched us eat. She sat closer to George, who was a bit surprised to see that a bite had been taken out of his new quarter pounder. My mother, chewing, gave him a smile. He was shocked. This kind of thing didn't happen in his family. George reminded my mom for a while after that she owes him a bite of cheeseburger. Then one day in college, he got a small package. Inside was, well, a bite of cheeseburger, with lipstick marks and all. I thought it was funny, but I wasn't surprised. That was just my mom, the funniest person I know. City street scene. Nuclear cloud in the distance, buildings on fire, car jams, people running, screaming, panicking, and a dog on the sidewalk looking down at an area on the street where there is nothing really to see. The caption, and then Jake saw something that grabbed his attention. My mother was shifted from hospital to hospital. I would call her up each time before coming over. Can you eat? I'd ask. She always said yes. The staff always said NPO. So I would eat the burger and fries in my car and would offer her a sip of Coke if she promised to spit it out. She never did. She craved simple things, starving for normal moments like eating at McDonald's, things I try not to take for granted now. Inside an Omelets R Us diner, a waitress delivers a huge omelet on a huge plate. Caption reads, Humpty Dumpty's final days. Days in the hospital turned into weeks, then months. Day by day, morphine slowly replaced reality. One of the hardest things I've ever had to do was add DNR to her chart, do not resuscitate. It meant that if my mom's heart were to stop, no one was to start it again. No heroic actions. It's what all the doctors and nurses recommended. I was alone outside the ICU, in the same hospital my father died, one floor up, just 9 months earlier. A man with glasses, wings, and a halo sits on a cloud in heaven thinking to himself, wish I'd brought a magazine. Caption reads, specialized obituaries. For a clown, the column is titled, Pied. A farmer bought the farm. A vampire staked. A cow kicked the bucket. The possum, not faking it. I tell my mom I love you each day, even if I was angry at her for something. Her mood had changed from the funniest person I knew to the angriest and the saddest. She's sometimes tired of me saying I love you, replying, yes, yes. When on a respirator, unable to speak, she was defenseless when I said it. A nod, or if it was a particularly hard day, a roll of the eyes. But soon, the morphine silenced her forever. She died the day before her 65th birthday. A dejected train engine begs for money on a city street with a plea sign reading, I thought I could. I thought I could. I buy the Farsight calendar from the bookshop, but since I'm leaving soon for the season, I rip a few weeks ahead to when I'll be back. Sitting in my kitchen, sipping a Coke, I think of a daisy. You know how you pluck the petals one by one? For each day I rip off the calendar, I say out loud, she loves me. She loves me not. She loves me. She loves me not. She loves me.
Seattle producer Jake Warga. Before that, Toronto musician Charles Spearin with his neighbor, Mrs. Morris, from The Happiness Project. And Katie Davis, I Live With My Mother, part of her neighborhood stories in D.C. Links to everything you heard are at hearingvoices.com. I'm Barrett Golding, wishing all you moms, especially mine, Happy Mother's Day.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of soundimagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is hearingvoices.com.